Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on the courtyard of the Gentiles Project, as well as on Matteo Ricci, who may have died 4 centuries ago, but whose legacy is still very much alive today. Finally, as October, the month of the Rosary, draws to a close, we enjoy a musical comment on the fifth joyful mystery of the Rosary. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Little over 4 centuries ago, an Italian Jesuit by the name of Matteo Ricci, who died in 1610, lived as a missionary in China. Fellow Jesuit Father Felix Corner heads the Faculty of Missiology today at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. I asked him to sit down with me in our studios here in an effort to find out more about this charismatic character. Matteo Ricci was a Jesuit, a humanist, a scientist, and a missionary. He wrote in his letters, "In all things I adapted myself to them," which means the Chinese. So in other words, a completely different culture. Would you say that it is his openness and respect for the Chinese culture that marks the success of his missionary zeal in China?
Quite clearly, this is one of his two legs on which he walked and one of his two hands with which he worked. It was a deep love and respect, and a deep love and respect shown also to the Chinese by the beautiful language he used, by the quotations he made. Yeah? So the Chinese felt, here's somebody who is really understanding us and who is feeling that we have a treasure to offer to the whole world. But the other leg on which he walked was his deep love and conviction that the presence of Christ transforms everything and can also transform Chinese culture. So this double method, this double conviction, I respect you and I rediscover Christ through the respect I have for the foreigner, for the strange culture, was what made him work and what made his work succeed.
It was very unusual at that time, he died in 1610. It wasn't so logical that one was so open to other cultures. He was a European, Matteo Ricci.
Yes.
He was born in Macerata and very Italian then. So how did he manage to balance these things? Because usually when missionaries went out, they tried to preach, whereas that wasn't his approach at all. He was very subtle, wasn't he?
You know, he was a Jesuit. And a Jesuit starts from the idea that every human person has already something to offer, has already a ground into which you can sow the seed of Christ. And this ground is necessary, is important for the whole church, is important for all of humanity. So treasuring what is already there, in classical language, respecting the nature before you speak about the supernatural, is something he brought along as a Jesuit. And therefore, he came into China and did not use this respect as a trick, but he was profoundly interested in discovering what China would have to offer to the whole human family. And he felt, onto that ground, onto that rich ground, I can sow the seed of the gospel.
The Jesuits in general, they were highly educated. I mean, we're talking of someone who was respected by the Chinese specifically because he was a scientist, apart from anything else. I mean, they respected that side to him.
Yes.
He fed into that, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he had his formation from what is today the Gregorian University, and he had his formation not only in theology. He brought along mathematics and sciences in a more general
like
sense,
what we are.
Exactly. So
even music, he
was. He was even a musician and a theorist on music. He could compose. The Chinese were really interested in learning from him to recalculate, for example, the calendar. Why was that important? If the emperor could predict that we will have a lunar phenomenon in the next 15 years. And then it really came about. The emperor showed that he was really in control of the cosmos. So it was interesting, it was even important for the emperor to have highest standard astronomy. Mathematics played a great role in that, and therefore the Chinese said, here is somebody who is not coming just as some street-walking monk who is bringing us a nice-sounding spirituality impulse, but somebody who can help us rethink life.
And someone who paradoxically is there to evangelize, in a sense, but he was also somebody who was shaped by the Chinese, no? It worked at two levels, didn't
it? Yeah, that's very interesting about him. Because he loved Chinese culture and tradition so much, he, in his literary production, always showed also how their own sources would come into his own philosophy. Even when he and his fellow Jesuits started designing the liturgy that should be celebrated in China, they brought in elements of Chinese tradition, to the point that after his death, the Catholic Church in Rome said, well, you have gone too far. You were compromising so much, you were respecting their culture so much that this should stop. Today, everybody recognizes this was an important thing and a good thing. Inculturation, bringing a strange culture into fruitful contact with the gospel, is something the whole church wants to do today. And the richness also of liturgical expressions is something that is part of the point of being Catholic today.
What is his legacy today at a theological level first?
The first thing is, it is not enough to be convinced of the meaning of Jesus Christ to be a credible witness of the Lord. You need to understand the culture you live in. You need to love it so much that it starts to speak to you. Only then you can speak to the people around you. And that makes sense not only when you go far away. This makes sense also when you speak to the people of your own country, of your own origin. This is the first point. The second thing is, you must know your own Christian theology so well that in contact with new questions, new ideas, new ways of expressing feelings, you can adapt the gospel, not compromise it, but make it speak in a new language. For that, you must be a very good theologian, otherwise you cannot do dialogue. You know, Benedict the 16th said to the Jesuits when they met in Rome for their general congregations, you have to be where the frontiers of today are. And we were really very happy to hear that he trusts us in risking new things. He knows, as a theologian who is constantly discussing with modern thought, that it can be dangerous, a risky thing to be at the borders, but for the gospel, for the Lord, and for the sake of truth, it is necessary to go to these borders again. So Ritchie is for us the encouragement and the example of risking new borders.
And many thanks there to Jesuit Father Felix Korner, the Dean of the Faculty of Missiology at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to turn for a moment to the world of culture here in the Vatican by speaking to someone you're probably familiar with. He's currently running a parish in Blundell Sands, north of Liverpool in England, but he's still involved with the Pontifical Council for Culture here in the Vatican. He's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, whose expertise in the field of culture and in the area of dialogue with people of no faiths is well known in Vatican circles. So much so that the president of this council, Cardinal-designate Archbishop Gianfranco Ravasi, asked him to help out in a creative new project by the title of The Courtyard of the Gentiles, A project which stems from Pope Benedict XVI's call to his closest advisers back in 2009 to draw inspiration from this courtyard, once part of the Jerusalem Temple. But stay tuned and listen to my conversation with Father Peter. So, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, you're now a parish priest in Blundell Sands, Liverpool, but you're still in touch with the council that you used to work for when you were here in Rome, which is the Pontifical Council for Culture, which is now headed by Archbishop Gianfranco Ravasi, who's ideated a project which has the wonderful name of the Courtyard of the Gentiles. Why is it called the Courtyard of the Gentiles?
It refers to part of the temple, and the Pope used this expression just before Christmas in 2009 when he was addressing people of the Roman Curia, and he said we should really have a place that we can call the courtyards of the Gentiles.
La Chiesa dovrebbe anche oggi aprire una sorta di cortile dei gentili.
I think that today, too, the Church should open a sort of court of the Gentiles in which people might in some way latch on to God without knowing Him and before gaining access to His mystery, at whose service the inner life of the Church stands.
He didn't mean a physical place, he meant some method of encountering people who feel that religion is something alien to them, but they're willing to engage in serious dialogue with believers. So the Courtyards of the Gentiles is an area in the Church's life where people who want to talk to believers are welcome. They feel they're welcome, they'll be taken seriously, and there'll be a serious, high-level discussion, and which will take many forms, on the way non-believers can speak to believers and vice versa in a productive way.
Do non-believers want to speak to believers?
Well, I think so. The recent visit of the Pope to England changed quite a few people's minds, because when they saw the man and heard what he had to say and saw how he presented his ideas, heard his ideas, they had to say to themselves, well, we think we got this wrong. A lot didn't, don't get me wrong. A lot still think they'll never agree with the Pope or his ideas or his church or whatever. But many people, I think, were quite engaged by his way of presenting what he believes. And also, when I was working at the council, I took it upon myself to write reports every time we issued our quarterly magazine on atheist and humanist organisations. But I never put a judgment in there. I just said that we knew what was going on. And eventually, the leaders of some of these atheist and humanist movements actually came to see who was writing this stuff, who was keeping an eye on them but not judging them, and it really was a door that opened wide, quite surprisingly. So I think there is a desire to talk, beyond the invective you sometimes hear and the aggressive rhetoric that can be on both sides, I have to admit. Beyond that, you often get people who really are keen to engage and know more of the other side's point of view.
Of course, maybe our listeners are not aware of this, but the Pontifical Council for Culture grew out of a council which was dedicated to non-believers. Is that correct?
Yeah, at the end of the Second Vatican Council, there was an organism there for dialogue with other Christians. There was one for dialogue with people of other religions. And there was one, finally, for dialogue with people of no faith. The Secretariat for Non-Believers, which eventually became, in the terminology of the Roman Curia, the Pontifical Council for Dialogue with Non-Believers. And eventually that was absorbed into a newer council called the Pontifical Council for Culture. So the work has always been there, ever since the mid-60s.
So getting back to this new project, it's getting off the ground now. And it has a general theme, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think what the Pope said was he'd like to meet people for whom religion is something alien, for whom God is unknown, and who, in any case, don't want to be simply without God, but to approach God at least as someone they don't know. And I think what he probably meant was people who are in some way, even a minute way, fascinated by the people they know who believe and obviously live and get energy and strength, apart from comfort and all those other things that people normally think of religion, but people who even think out of their faith, you know, for whom their faith is really part of the impulse for daily life.
As you mentioned, this courtyard of the gentles is not a physical space. It can move around quite easily. That's what it's going to do, isn't it?
Yeah,
in different areas.
I suppose maybe a modern word for it, and a contemporary word, might be the interface between believers and non-believers. And of course, that's everywhere in the world where there are believers and non-believers who bump into each other in one way or another. The first event is going to be in a place that has been chosen because of its symbolic value. That's Paris. I suppose those who are old enough to remember will think back to the days of the late 1960s when the university and the Left Bank and the Boulevard Saint-Michel were the place for thinkers to meet and to, you know, to think out of the box, to think new, think of a new society, new ethics. Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, many, many other well-known thinkers. So they'll be meeting in UNESCO, whose whole purpose is to recognise that wars start in the mind and wars can be finished in the mind. They'll be meeting at the Sorbonne, very high-level intellectual place. And the
university.
Yeah, and the Catholic Institute of Paris. Three different places for people of great minds to meet specifically on the subject of non-belief. And there will be a dramatic event, really, on the threshold of Notre Dame Cathedral, at the end of which people will be invited to come into the cathedral. There'll be no pressure on anybody to pray, but non-believers will be invited to come in and think their own thoughts, be there simply, and the Taizé community will provide 45 minutes of meditative music and prayer. As I say, no one is being forced to pray, but people being asked to be together in a sacred space, as well as the external space they've already shared time in. I suppose the idea really is to give space and time for discussion, but not just for discussion, also for taking each other seriously, hearing each other, rather than talking about each other, talking to each other, which is always, you know, it's always a move forward.
Surely you have to have a theme to talk about, some sort of specific theme, no?
Well, I think in the Catholic Institute in Paris, they were talking about ethics and finance, law and various cultural points of view, and also art, worship and culture. In the Sorbonne, it'll be more a question of recognising what's happened in France, but more broadly elsewhere, since the Enlightenment. France would be known as the cradle of the Enlightenment, really, although much of it grew in eventually in Germany and England and America, North America. So there are particular themes for particular places. I think in one of the planned events, probably the one in Sweden, where the Swedish Academy is working with the Pontifical Council for Culture, that's the partner there, I think they're going to have a session of interviews and discussions which eventually will lead into people together writing a play, which they'll then perform.
You mean believers and non-believers writing together?
Yes, yeah. And the idea is to be as creative as possible in as many different fields of creativity as possible, in as many different places as possible. There's also been contact with an institute in Albania, so that people who've lived under militant and state-sponsored atheism may now, after the restrictions have gone, begin to discuss a subject that really was taboo for many, many years. And then the idea is to move out gradually. I think Sweden is a way into the Nordic countries. It is a known fact that Norway, for example, has more humanist organisations than anywhere else in Europe. And I think it's probably outstripped only by the United States because of its size, and India, which has got a phenomenal number of organisations against religion because there's such a multiplicity of religions in India. As yet, I don't think there's any plan for the Courtyard of Gentiles to go that far, but it will hopefully do so. And one of my tasks that I've just been given is to try and find ways into universities, major universities in England and Wales, so that we can have high-level encounters, meetings, I suppose we'd say in English, meetings between academics who are for and against religion. People who take each other seriously, by no means do they need to agree, probably much better if they disagree, to create a very lively and productive debate.
So what starts in Europe is intended to move across the world in different continents, because we are a universal church, aren't we?
Yeah, well, the question is, we start where we have contacts, good contacts, and then build up more contacts. And I think from the few reactions I've seen already, there is interest in this project, but it's just that it hasn't been articulated, certainly not in English, very clearly up to now. So the more it's known, I think the more interest it will arouse. And I do think it'll spread very quickly. I know that at the forthcoming plenary meeting of the Pontifical Council for Culture, an American contact will be asked, what are the possibilities in the university where he works? So, you know, there is a little push, gentle, but, firm attempt to move as far away as we can.
A gentle push for the courtyard of the Gentiles, then.
Yes, yes, gentle Gentiles. I may not sound very excited in my voice, but I really am happy, because when I worked at the council, it was very clear that it was necessary to continue the dialogue, but I'm delighted that there's a more creative approach now come along. We're being asked to be as creative as possible and to engage as many creative minds as we can meet and interest in the project. So I think it can only do good, and a lot of good. It might take time, but it will work.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. Many thanks go to him. Finally, as I mentioned earlier on in the broadcast, as October, the month of the Rosary, draws to a close, I'd like to bring you a musical comment on the last of the joyful mysteries of the Rosary. That's with Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Joyful mystery, the finding of our Lord in the temple. Having travelled with Mary and Joseph from Galilee to Jerusalem, the 12-year-old Jesus becomes separated from them, and he stays behind in the temple without them realising. Imagine the anguish they must have experienced as they looked for him. It must be every parent's worst fear. "Son, why have you treated us like this?" Mary said when they found him. "Your father and I have been looking for you everywhere." Joseph already knew the pain of loss, the sorrow that would be crowned when Our Lady stood at the foot of the cross, weeping for her son. At this point, though, her joy at finding Jesus safe and well is clouded by her perplexity. She doesn't understand what has happened. In his cryptic reply, the boy Jesus utters the first words placed on Our Lord's lips in St. Luke's Gospel. "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's affairs?"
Oh, boy.
the beginning of the programme, we were listening to some violin music. It was written by the 17th century German composer Heinrich Bieber, one of the leading violinists of his time. He worked in Salzburg for the Prince Archbishop, as Leopold Mozart and his famous son did during the following century. One of Bieber's best-known works is his set of so-called mystery sonatas. There are 15 in all, and each one is named after one of the mysteries of the Rosary. That was in the days before Pope John Paul II added the five mysteries of light. The sonata for the fifth joyful mystery has five short movements, and like much of the solo instrumental music of that period, they're arranged as a suite of dances. The central movement is a lively jig. After that comes a saraband, a stately Spanish dance. It would be stretching a point to try and find too many specific references to the Fifth Joyful Mystery in this attractive violin sonata. The music doesn't attempt to tell the story or to represent the characters in the unfolding drama. But I like to think of the violin as somehow expressing the youthful intelligence and energy of the boy Jesus, sitting among the doctors, listening to them and asking them questions. And the words he addresses to Mary are the most striking of all. Did you not know that I must be busy with my Father's affairs? It's a moment of revelation when Jesus gives us a clue about who he really is. Mary stored up all these things in her heart. As we pray the Rosary, let us do the same.
And warm thanks there once again to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Be sure to join us again at the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.